It's Border Crossings with Larry London from VOA 1.
Hi, this is Border Crossings, and welcome to the Voice of America. My name is Larry London, and I'm happy to have you here on Border Crossings today as we welcome into our studios an artist who's been around for a number of years, celebrating several decades of making music her own way, on her own terms. We welcome Celtic performer Lorena McKennon into our studios. Lorena is right now on tour promoting her latest projects, which we'll be talking about this hour. She plays the harp, she plays the accordion, she plays a number of instruments and does them all so well. And of course, her very, very well-known voice became famous on a big hit that I was playing a number of years back called The Mummer's Dance. We'll find out what a mummer is, as well as enjoy the sounds of Lorena McKennon. Coming up this hour, right here on today's Border Crossings. Hi, this is Larry London, and we welcome you to Border Crossings. Today in our studios, a music icon who's been in the business for a number of years. In fact, she's celebrating her 30th anniversary of one of her albums being re-released. We'd like to welcome to Washington, D.C., Lorena McKennitt. It's great to have you in D.C.
Great to be here.
Congratulations on all the success. And so we're revisiting a number of albums right now, I understand.
Yes, we're releasing some of our projects on vinyl as well as in box sets. Many as the industry has evolved and people are looking for things in different formats, we've decided we were going to try and facilitate that.
You know, I understand there's a resurgence in vinyl. That seems to be, you know, the in thing nowadays. But and I was wondering, where can someone get a turntable, a record player, if they want to play a vinyl album?
Well, I imagine at various audiophile shops they would be carrying them. They probably never completely went out of business on that. It's been interesting to see this resurgence of vinyl. I mean, you hear perhaps a lot more about it than it really reflects in the number of sales, you know, in the whole composition of CD or download or vinyl sales. But I think for music such as my own or classical music, jazz, where fidelity is actually part of the experience, and you really do get that with vinyl.
Well, we're thrilled to have you in our studios. You know, I remember when I was actually on the radio in Detroit playing the Mummer's Dance. That's, you know, a number of years ago. And I often wondered then, and I'll ask now since you're here, what is a mummer? What exactly is a mummer?
Well, it's a tradition that you'd find particularly in Ireland. And they would go around on St. Stephen's Day or Boxing Day, as we would call it. And they would be dressed up in costumes and masks. Sometimes they'd be satire or take off on politicians. I remember going to a wonderful take on Halloween on the Aran Islands. That was a kind of mummer's version where people were dressed up in costumes, but they didn't say a word. So that whole take off on mumming. But in Ireland, they would come around to people's place. They would sort of dance a set. There would be musicians with them, but they wouldn't speak. And then they'd leave the house, and the host of the house would often leave the dancers and the musicians and the mummers with you know, some food or some kind of gesture of hospitality.
Yeah, and I remember playing that song. That was great. One of your biggest hits. Were you surprised that it took off like it did back in the day here in the United States?
Oh, yes. I was very surprised. I mean, you know, thinking, well, I would think that a song on a bunch of mummers in Ireland or in Newfoundland would ever hit the top 100. But yes, I was surprised. It took its own evolution. The folks from Warner Brothers, I was signed to Warner Music Canada at the time, and we worked with Warner Brothers Records out of the States. And they said, well, this song would also be very suitable for a remix. So the remix version was really the version that hit radio. But I was also concerned that I didn't want the remix to stretch the cultural kind of genre which I was performing in so far that people would be buying the remix and then buying the album and feeling like they were misled. But we didn't get too many complaints, thankfully.
Well, you've had an illustrious career, and you know, your music has been influenced from what I've been reading in a number of different areas. I mean, Shakespearean influences, obviously the Celtic music, but Arabic music through the Celtic music? How did that work?
Well, as I'm fond of saying in the concerts, that I first understood the Celts to be this mad collection of anarchists from Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, but I quickly learned that that was not the case. They were this vast collection of tribes that had fanned out across Europe and into Asia Minor and date back to about 500 BC. So I learned this particularly at an exhibition I attended in Venice around 1991, and it was the most extensive exhibition ever assembled on the Celts. So when I realized that the Celts had actually gone across that swath of geography and time, I thought, you know, there are a lot of people performing the traditional music far better than I could. And I thought, well, I'll pursue the history of the Celts and undertake a sort of a version of musical travel writing in the process of doing so. So it has taken me to some very interesting places. I think of a museum up in the northwest corner of China where they have mummies with red hair and tartans. Or I spent some time with a nomadic family in Mongolia, and it's believed that the earliest Celts' passion for horses probably started by being exposed to people there. Or an archaeological site outside of Ankara in Turkey. And so there's been a lot of travel that's been involved in the research, and I've used that travel as a kind of a very important platform from which I could embark upon my writing.
We've got Lorena McKennitt at our studios on tour and promoting her beautiful music around the world, truly a world-known artist, which we don't often have the opportunity to say that in the true context. And you've sold over 14 million records around the world, and you continue to work hard to this very day. And I guess you're kind of taking your own career in your own hands. You have your own label, your own management company.
Yes, this started out in the 80s when I put out my first recording in 1985. And I'd love to say that I knew what I was doing at the time, but I knew probably what I didn't want to do. And I slowly built my career by financing my recordings, by busking in the street or putting on small concerts in churches and school auditoriums, until about 1991 I signed a licensing deal with the Warner Music Group, and it was at that point my career took another jump. But I have taken the unusual step of not having traditional management, but rather having my own staff, and that's allowed me to really have my hands in the business all the time and be able to follow along and adjust. And so even though the music industry has really collapsed drastically, I've been able to continue coasting along, partially on my legacy or other artists who have built a certain profile by, let's say, 1998 or 2000. But also, I think, because I've kept my operation quite close and quite small.
Different kinds of pressure, I guess, when you're kind of running your own company. You have things to do and that you wouldn't do if you were working for someone else.
Well, I must say that I create far less than I otherwise would have. I know if I had the traditional arrangement, I would be spending more time writing music and composing. And sort of the compromise or trade-off I made with myself many years ago, I knew I would create less, but I wanted to make sure that those creations were looked after as best they could. And the music industry is a very patchy reputation in terms of how artists, whether they're copyrights and masters or how they've been managed. So that wasn't something that would rest very well with me. I always wanted to be a veterinarian, and I always came to this business in a, not at all costs. So, I found my own way of making my way through.
That's a very interesting transition from veterinarian to professional musician. Mm. You obviously, at the time, it must have been a difficult decision.
Well, to a degree it was. I only spent about 3 months at the University of Manitoba studying agriculture. And at that point, there were a number of opportunities that came up, and I knew I would always wonder how far I would go with music. So I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. And at that time, I was doing musical theater and playing in lounges and a real broad swath of things. But I moved to Stratford, Ontario in 1981 and worked at the theater there for 4 years. And then in 1985, when I made my first recording, that was really the first step on the career path that I'm still on.
Your parents were in music?
No, interestingly enough, my father was a livestock dealer and my mother was a nurse, and there wasn't a lot of music in our household, but there was a lot of music in our small community, Morden, Manitoba. It was 3,500 people. And there was a very large German Mennonite community and still is in that community. And they're very, very strong in music, whether it's in church or at the school level, etc. So I felt, and both my music teachers were Mennonite, and I felt that the strength of music in the schools and in the community was really a huge benefit for me, and actually a number of others who came from that community that would go on, perhaps not quite as far as I did, but they did go on quite far in their own musical careers. So it's been interesting to reflect, even from an anthropological standpoint, of music in the home. Is it absolutely necessary to have music in the home? Not necessary, but if you can have music being played in the home. And it's been fascinating to meet other people who've had prominent careers who said, well, there was always a lot of music played in the household. Even with recordings and a time of being able to operate that turntable.
I'm sure you were happy having music in your home. Do you have Scottish blood and Irish blood?
Well, the MacKinnetts originally came from Inverness in Scotland, mm-hmm. and then went to Donegal in Ireland for a short period of time. And they came to Canada in the 1830s, which was about 10 years before the Irish famine, during which time there was a considerable Irish emigration to Canada and, of course, to the United States.
Hmm. Well, we've got some music to look forward to. I don't want to keep talking. I can talk to you endlessly, but I'd like to ask if you wouldn't mind doing a song for us.
Yes, this is a piece that has its origins in Ireland. There was a time when Ireland was very heavily forested, and over the course of centuries, the trees were taken down, in particular to support a shipbuilding industry that was happening in the north. And the author, whose name is now long forgotten, also makes a very astute note that the trees are much more than the raw trees in a forest, but are also provide the habitat for wildlife. So this is a piece called Bonnie Portmore.
Absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Thank you.
Your voice is beautiful. Hasn't skipped a beat in 30 years. You sound great. You look great.
Thank you.
Does it feel like it's been 30 years?
Oh, no, it doesn't. You know how that time certainly has flown. No, you're just so busy with your head to the ground. It doesn't seem like 30 years at all. But before I forget, I'd like to also introduce the folks that I'm playing with that are just fabulous. On cello is Miss Caroline Lavelle, who hails from Cornwall, England, another kind of Celtic corner. And Mr. Brian Hughes, who's from Los Angeles now, originally from Edmonton. He's playing guitars and so on. And indeed, Brian came into the picture. We started working, I guess, about 1988, which was pretty close to the beginning. And Caroline came in a few years later, and we've been working together. And I think that's one of the most enriching things about this whole, 30 years is working with people who are not only incredibly talented, but just make the whole experience just very pleasurable.
And it's great that you're so loyal to people that you keep the same musicians with you for a long, long time.
Well, loyalty is a very strong ingredient in my life, as you probably recognize that they're incredibly talented. So it's not a difficulty being loyalty and having loyalty to them. But there are many factors that go into working with folks and touring with folks because you're living very close quarters for long periods of time. So it's good.
Well, I'll tell you what, 7 albums in, and people keep asking, when's the next new album coming out? When's the next new album coming out?
Yes, well, it's been slower than I would have wished. It's that one of those things of life taking over. A couple of years ago, I set out to start the serious research for the next recording, and this took me to Rajasthan in India because there are some links between Indian culture and the earliest Celts. In fact, those mummies up in Urumqi in northwest China that would have dated back to 1000 BC, they spoke a language that sits in the Indo-European group of languages, and the Gaelic or the Celtic languages sit on the other side of the spectrum, but they still are part of that. So it's been interesting for me to see what I might uncover in the pursuit of that Celtic-Indian connection. And there's without question that trip gave me a tremendous wealth of ideas and imagery. But it just seems to be very, very hard to get larger swaths of time to be creative and live the other side of my brain.
Now, when you're traveling the world and touring, I'm sure you get inspiration, as you mentioned, from India. You get from different places. Mm-hmm. And all of the travels must impact the sound or the style of the writing that you're doing at the time.
They do. Although, when we're touring, that's not really the kind of travel that I would use to... every once and again, we'll have an experience or see something. But I usually, at the beginning of a recording cycle, I'll set myself out on the road by myself. And, is when I went up to China or with this nomadic family in Mongolia, I find that traveling on my own, there's a kind of vulnerability that comes with that. And with that vulnerability, you're sort of a bit more open to impressions. And also you people like to take you in sometimes and show you some special corners. Whereas if you're traveling with other people, they think, oh, well, you're covered off and you're okay. But there's some incredible places where I've been throughout Morocco and down into the desert. As I mentioned earlier, into China, into Mongolia. I find that when I'm in the writing phase, and particularly in the recording phase, that after all that traveling, there's an image that gets distilled in my mind's eye. And so with almost every song that I've created and recorded, there is an image in my mind that corresponds with that. I'm sure everybody has their own unique images. But I find that always very, very helpful when I go into the studio because I line up that image with each track we're laying down. And if the track doesn't kind of line up with that image, it doesn't last. So sometimes that manifests itself in terms of grooves or a certain instrument, or even the idiom in which the instrument is played. I know we worked on a Winter Garden, which is a 5-song EP, and one of the pieces we worked on was God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, and we had a wonderful Egyptian fiddler who brought the real Middle East to that piece, but it was only through the idiom of his fiddle playing that gave it that kind of authenticity.
And when you talk about instruments, when did you begin your love affair with the harp?
Well, I think my love affair with the harp began in the late 70s when I was part of a music, it was a group. We just casually would get together on a Sunday night and play traditional tunes. A number of the members from that group were from Ireland or Scotland and England. And one of the recordings that they brought was of a harper from Brittany called Hélène Stivell. Wonderful, wonderful harper. And of course, there were also the recordings of the chieftains. And when I heard not only the Celtic music, but I heard the harp in it, I thought, that's something that really speaks to me. But it wasn't until, I guess, 1981 or 82, when I was in London, England, quite by chance, passed by a little shop in Hampstead, across from the Royal Free Hospital, and saw a secondhand troubadour harp for sale in this shop that was selling actually antique musical instruments, and the owner was primarily selling this as a favour. So the troubadour harps are built in Chicago by a company called Lyon and Healy, and so it's a student harp that many classical harpists learn to play on before they proceed to a classical harp. So it's portable, but it has enough of a range that I can do some things with it. But you would not, I mean, if you put me next to a real properly trained harpist, you'll realize that what I do is the equivalent of kind of one or two finger typing on a typewriter.
And a harper, is that what it's called? Somebody who plays the harp is a harper?
A harper.
I've never heard that. I thought it was a harpist. A harper.
Well, both.
Well, that's great. It's a lovely instrument. And I know that, you know, you mentioned troubadour, and immediately, you know, Juno Awards come to mind, and Grammy Awards come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so congratulations on the Juno Awards. That's, you know, Canada's most prestigious music award. You've won not one, but two of them.
Thank you.
So that's wonderful. And,
yes.
And everything is just coming together beautifully for you. I mean, it's just, you must be in a real happy place right now.
Well, we are. I think particularly, as I say, given the industry is in such a state of disarray, that to be able to still be relevant and viable 30 years later is a good feeling. I mean, I think the other thing is that I not setting my hat aside as a performer, I'm also very interested but concerned about the state of music in just general life, family life, and community life. So, anyway, just trying to do my part.
You're bringing some beautiful music to the world, and we are all, on behalf of the worldwide audience, we're grateful for you. Lorena McKennett's in our studio. So would you do another song for us?
Sure. This is a piece, it's a poem that of W.B. Yeats that I set to music. And ever since learning about the potentially compromising factors of ubiquitous connection technology and children, it's taken on a whole different kind of interpretation for me. So it's a poem that W.B. Yeats wrote, capturing a lot of the very beautiful, magical, rural and wildlife kind of places he grew up in Ireland. It's called The Stolen Child.
Tips the rocky highland of Sleuthwood in the lake. There lies the leafy island where flapping herons wake. The drowsy water runs, there we've heard a fairy fence full of berries and a variety of stolen cherries. Come on. Thank you. hills above Glencar, in pools among the rushes that scarce could bathe a star. We seek for so long winter out, and we spring in our ears, give them unquiet dreams, leaning softly out from fans that drop their tears of other young streams. Come away, a human child, to the waters and wild, with a fairy hand in hand, for the world's more full of weeping than he can understand.
Lovely. Take us to another place, up in the clouds. Lorena McKennitt's in our studios. I should call you Colonel, I guess, Colonel Lorena McKennitt from the Royal Air Force.
Yes, yes. This, as I relate to the audience sometimes, that in 2006 I was asked to be the honorary colonel of a search and rescue and transport squadron in the Royal Canadian Air Force out of Winnipeg. This transport squadron is out of Winnipeg. And last year I was asked to be the honorary colonel for the Royal Canadian Air Force. And it's been a very eye-opening path of 9 years or so, not coming from a family who was in the military in any way. I mean, in Canada, we have a fairly, you know, neutral military, shall we say, and they're very much instructed by the government of the day. And the government of the day is voted in by we, the citizens. So it's been... yeah, it's been very, very interesting to see what they do for Canadians, the international community, in terms of sovereignty patrol, search and rescue, disaster relief, peacemaking, peacekeeping, combat roles. And
all very worthwhile causes. Now, you don't fly, do you? I mean, you were given
I'm
this,
not a pilot,
no,
but I fly with
them. No, I thought, if they're going to call you Colonel of the Air Force.
But I do fly with them from time to time. In fact, the squadron is a fixed air wing aircraft, Hercules, C-130. Mm-hmm. And so I've flown up to Alert, which is our most northern community in Canada. And I've traveled across all of Canada and actually down into Key West doing some search and rescue joint exercises with the folks down here in the States. And I've been overseas to support some of our teams of people abroad.
Mm. And you talk about, you know, Canada, obviously, that's home. You were at the Canadian Embassy before you came here.
I was, indeed, yes.
So I'm thrilled to see you every time you come through.
Well, the ambassador, Gary Doer, is originally from Manitoba. He was the premier of Manitoba, and Manitoba is where I grew up. So I've had, and of course, that's all where I continue to have roots with respect to my family and the Air Force Squadron. So, yes, it was wonderful to see him again and, you know, We just sharing notes about our mutual friendship with our neighbors here to the south, and it's a friendship we greatly cherish.
It must be wonderful to be rubbing elbows with queens and kings and ambassadors. I know that you've performed for Queen Elizabeth.
Yes.
And
dined with her. Gary was reminding me of that because he was fairly instrumental in when she had her Diamond Jubilee mm-hmm. and was passing through Winnipeg. So we performed for her, but they also asked if I would like to join them at the dinner table. So there was one individual between myself and Her Highness. But yes, but you know, at the end of the day, everyone's just human beings, I think. You know, I think
exactly.
That's what comes across.
But you're bringing the world a lot of great music and looking back on 30 years, I mean, is there a highlight, something that stands out above? Because you truly are worldwide, and so it must be pretty hard to isolate one thing. But
it is hard to isolate one thing. I mean, there were phases of my career. When I really got started, I was busking on the street. So mm-hmm. My career was built literally brick by brick and over a long period of time. So there was no sudden success with this. Mm-hmm. I look back on those busking days quite fondly. And of course, playing on the streets, you're always open to all kinds of adventures and misadventures. I remember one adventure at Covent Garden in London, England, where I was some friends of mine had gone down to see me perform, and they were parking this van, and I set up on James Street outside of Covent Garden, and I performed for a while, and people seemed to be enjoying themselves, and all of a sudden a policeman came up, and he said, "I'm sorry, you're not allowed to perform here. You have to have a permit," and so I started packing my things up, and he went off, and then my friends came back and they said, "Oh, can't you perform just a few more songs?" So I set up the harp again and performed a few more songs, and then I noticed the policeman coming back towards me, and he was not amused this time, and he was barely 3 feet from me, and this woman emerged from my right hand side, and she intercepted him by saying, "Oh, officer, I know you're going to ask this lady to move along, but do you realize there's a man right behind her that's exposing himself, and couldn't you take him away instead?" So he's saved by the flasher. So, you know, there have been moments like that straight through to, you know, singing and some very poignant kind of situations. It's been a career path that I couldn't have ever dreamed of, really. Far more successful, not just in terms of units sold or money or something, but I think for me, success is very much having an incredible opportunity to learn about the world, to learn about people, to travel, and hopefully learn enough that one can get to a place where you can actually put back into the community and be of service in some way.
The journey so far.
The journey so far.
A perfect name for a greatest hits album and a greatest hits. You're putting out a special box set for the greatest hits.
Yes, we've just released in this past year or so a compilation of some of the more popular pieces so far, and now was actually asked to put together a compilation. So it's some of the more recent studio recordings. There's actually three box sets.
Wow.
And sort of the journey begins, the journey continues, and the journey so far.
Wow, that's great. That's a lot of hits.
Yeah, well,
three box sets.
Yeah.
Whew.
So it's interesting. I mean, sometimes in retail, and they want things packaged in a certain way, and that all works for everybody. So, and sometimes people are coming on board. This is one of the fascinating things about some of our concerts is I'm now starting to see two generations, sometimes even three generations. So people came in, some folks came in the early 80s, and some people are just coming in now. So we're finding that the compilation or the boxes are a quick way to get folks caught up.
And it's great. It's music for all ages, as you mentioned. And it's amazing that you have so much time. You're involved with several charity organizations as well. You're still very giving of yourself.
Well, I think that, you know, I have this phrase that goes through my mind a lot of the time, that we're living off the legacy, and we're living off of legacy of those who put in before us in so many ways in our societies and communities. And that the fruits of what we're able to enjoy in our lives is been built on that legacy. And it is that thing of trying to move forward. In 1998, I set up a water safety fund after my fiancé perished in a boating accident, and that's gone on to assist in water safety initiatives, not just in Canada now. In fact, one of the people that supports is working with the United States and other organizations in harmonizing life jacket and PFD standards. So there's that project. In 2000, I purchased a heritage school and turned it into a family center. And that's been an incredible initiative. It's offered me a chance to learn a lot more about child development, particularly through one of the tenants there they deliver a program called Early Years. And the underpinnings of that program is based on some more current knowledge based on child development. So that is a very wonderful enterprise that feeds me in many ways, and then of course putting back in the RCAF and there you go.
Are you still doing a world tour right now? The tour that you're on, is it just in the U.S. or are you going?
No, it's just in the U.S. and it's just in this part of the U.S. or in the Eastern Seaboard. We've set off on this trio tour last year, and we toured around Quebec and Eastern Ontario, just Brian, Caroline, and myself. And we felt that the modality worked very well. And it hadn't been, it's been some years since I performed in the United States. So I thought, well, I didn't want to take any success for granted. I thought, well, let's go back in a modest way and just see what kind of interest there is. As well as there were people writing me over the years saying, we love all the bigger band and the Eastern and Middle Eastern kinds of things, but we also like the more traditional or the simpler material of the earlier years. So this presentation, the trio presentation, allows us to give people that kind of experience. It allows me, for better or for worse, to talk a lot more. When I've got the bands around me, I feel very, very self-conscious about droning on about things. But I like to share my experiences, particularly studying the history of the Celts and where that's taken.
It's fascinating to hear, because I know you've traveled, many different countries and had many different experiences. And so do you get to go back to Ireland often?
I make it back once or twice a year. I would love to go back more frequently or stay longer, but it's just wearing too many hats. I think that's a contemporary society thing.
Yes, yes.
But I do. I go back and I feel sometimes it's a bit like touching the stone, And I've been delighted actually to see and hear a very strong another generation coming up playing the traditional music in the pubs and step dancing. In recent years, I've been going back to a gathering on the 1st of February, which is St. Bridget's Day. In County Clare, they have a couple of sessions which are purely singing. There's not really instruments involved. And the mean average age is maybe 70, 75. And these people are singing songs that are 20, 25 verses long. And I go and embarrass myself by singing something 3 or 4 verses. But and in the pubs there are a lot of young people playing, so it's wonderful, really, really wonderful to see.
Would you do another song for us?
Sure. As you mentioned at the top, I've taken an interest in some of the what I call the Dead Poets Society, whether it's Shakespeare, Tennyson, or Alfred Noyes. This falls in that camp. It's one of the earlier pieces that I set to music. It's called The Lady of Shalott. Thank you.
And up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies blow. Round an island there below, the island of Shalott. Only reapers reaping curly in amongst the bearded valley. Hear a song that echoes cheery from the river winding clearly, flowing down to Camelot. And by the moon the reaper weary, piling sheaves in the Blansherry, listening whispers, 'tis the fairy, the lady of Shalott. There she weaves both night and day, a magic web with colors gay. She has heard a whisper say, the curses on her if she stay, to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaves steadily. Little other care from her barber heaves, he rode between the barley sheaves. The sun came dazzling through the leaves and flamed upon the brazen greaves of bold Sir Lancelot. Red Cross Knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield and sparkled on the air. Beside remote Shalott, she left the web, she left the loom. She made three paces through the room. She saw the water lily bloom. She saw the helmet and the plume. She looked to Camelot. Up flew the web and floated wide. Mirror cracked from side to side. The curses come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. In the stormy east wind straining, the pale yellow woods were waning. The broad stream in his banks complaining, heavily the low sky raining over towered Camelot. And down she came and found a boat beneath a willow left afloat, and round about the prow she wrote, the Lady of Shalott. Who is this and what is here? In the light perilous near, died the scent of royal cheer, and they crossed themselves for fear, the knights at Camelot. And Lancelot mused a little space. He said she has a lovely face. God in his mercy lent her grace.
Oh, mesmerizing. Mesmerizing, exquisite, lovely. What a pleasure it is to have you in our studios.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us and doing this, Lorena McKenna. Where can people reach out to you? Is there you have social media sites and things like that?
We're still in the dark ages with a website, I suppose. It's lorenamckennett.com. And pretty much anything you would want to know is probably there.
Wow. So. Celebrating 30 years. Congratulations on what has been a wonderful journey so far.
Yes, I'm sure the journey will continue
for many more years. And when you put out your next new album, please come back.
Thank you. Will do.
Hi, this is Larry London, and I thank you so much for tuning in to Border Crossings for today's show. And I want to thank Lorena McKennett for joining us on our very special program. I hope you enjoyed today's special and enjoyed the music from Lorena McKennett. I know I did. Fantastic. And so interesting to listen to. We'll be back again tomorrow with more Border Crossings. I'm Larry London. Have a great night. Thank you to Felicia, our producer-director, for helping with today's show. Border Crossings is heard on the VOA1 Music Network.